football on Off the Ball.
Well, I think man management is far more nuanced nowadays, as you're suggesting, because the dressing rooms have changed. You've got players from different faiths, different cultures, different communities, and you've got to reflect all that. These are player whisperers as well as player shouters.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Okay, so we're very lucky that Richard Fitzpatrick is in studio with us, as opposed to down the line. You're in Dublin today because the official launch, or the Irish launch anyway, of Helenio Herrera, football's original master of the dark arts, is out. The book arrived in and Arthur went, oh my God, that's beautiful. It is beautiful.
It's an amazing cover design. Love it, yeah. Kind of brutalist.
Appropriately so, yeah.
Very much so.
Helenio Herrera is one of those names that kind of has echoed down through football history. Every kid who is in any way interested in the history of the European Cup, which I suspect is everybody who's watching, looks at the list of honours and goes, okay, that Real Madrid team, that's Di Stefano, and how they stole him from Barcelona is the mythology around that. And then you work down through the period of time and you end up at the late 60s and the British team starting to get good. And in the meantime, HH's two teams go, his team goes back to back for two of them. And I suspect that most of us and our generation knew very little about him beyond he's a storied name at the birth of football's greatest competition. And when did you start realising or understanding that there was way more to him worth finding out about?
Yeah, very similar. He was, just in my consciousness as the godfather of Catenaccio, but I didn't know much about him. I moved to Barcelona in 2010 and I started more or less immediately writing a book on the Clásico rivalry and discovered more about him. He loomed large in the history of Barcelona. He was, they have a cult of the manager at Barca, and he was the first great manager at the club in the late 1950s. He took on that Di Stefano's Real Madrid that you just mentioned, and he had their number domestically over those years. He was there in 58 to 60. But he's not really known outside of Spain and Italy in the same regard as he is in those countries. So I was fascinated with him essentially because he was such an entertaining character. He obviously had great success with winning back-to-back league titles with Atletico as well in Spain, as well as with Barca, and then moving on to La Grande Inter in Italy in the 60s. But he was an absolutely outrageous character, and there was rumours about him to do with doping and match fixing, but I didn't think much of it beyond that until a few years later, around 2015 or that, I discovered that he was involved in the first alleged doping death in football, what's called the first white death in football. 2 years after Tommy Simpson, the Tour de France cyclist, died, one of his players died from alleged doping at Roma in 69. So I was there, wow, there's a story here. Like, I'd always been interested in doping and sport, basically because of the Lance Armstrong story, watching you guys like cover with, of course, obviously Paul Kimmage and David Walsh led the charge in bringing Lance Armstrong down. But so to have a story in football about doping was their gut, and he ended up in court charged with manslaughter. There's some story here, so that was the spur to dive into it.
It helps that he's also like an outrageous, larger than life character who was charming but had no friends, is one of the lines that stuck out.
Yeah, he was very enigmatic character. Like huge, huge charm. Like he could, he had an amazing man management style. Like was brilliant at motivating players, getting inside their heads and driving them onto great things. Was like he was diabolical, as one of his former players, Joaquin Pero, said. He was dropped at one stage. He played with him for Inter and Spain and at AS Roma, and he was dropped. And then suddenly HH needed him for a game. He was arm around the shoulder for the week, cajoling him, getting him motivated for the game. And then he would come alive in the match. And he said, it was it was diabolical in his words that he was able to do this. But he was a lonely character then. He wouldn't let people into his inner circle. They hadn't any close friends in the game. He was an unbelievable womanizer, incredible at charming women, but, you know, it was very unfaithful, obviously, to his wives, and that really violent
man.
The three wives, yeah, and many, many children, 7, 8 children. But also, he was extremely violent, and this really struck me, probably the womanizing and the violent streak in him. Like I would, like many of us, be fascinated with Alex Ferguson. Like, you know, Ferguson famous for his hairdryer treatment, but this guy, I mean, would headbutt people that got in his way. He grew up in the slums in Casablanca, in the interwar years. So his resort to violence was a pronounced feature of his personality. Yet he was practicing meditation and, you know, yoga, practicing yoga naked every morning, chanting self-help mantras to himself. You know, I feel strong, calm, serene. I am lucky. I am also beautiful, you know, bigging himself up. So he was such a curious mix of influences, from Zen to skullduggery to physical violence.
And wildly successful.
Incredible. Like, you know, back-to-back league titles with Atletico, they'll never again win back-to-back league titles, you would think. Same with Barca. And then Grand Inter in the 60s were the team to beat in that decade. That's why when they met their Waterloo at the 67 European Cup final, losing to Celtic, which was a huge surprise, everybody rejoiced. I interviewed Hugh McIlvany, who sadly passed, for the book. He was in the dressing room that day in Lisbon when Celtic won, and he said everybody was just ecstatic that they had beaten the king of anti-football in the decade.
When you were talking about it, you mentioned Ferguson there, but like it's there's almost slightly crestfallen that there was nothing new about Mourinho when he arrived. That does many of the characteristics, the legal ones that you've spoken about. There was a bang of Mourinho off it, and I'm like, history just repeats itself, except with slightly different characters.
100%. He Mourinho used his playbook. That's all the signs, the motivational techniques. You know, writing. Slogans on the dressing room walls, which HH did. Mourinho did that 4 decades later with Chelsea, particularly the bombast in the media, playing the media games, trying to distract attention from his players. Really out of, it came easily to HH because he had such a huge ego. He loved waging war on rival managers and goading rival players in the press and easing up that attention. He was in love with the camera. He also reminded me of Guardiola in just the intensity, the obsessiveness. Like, the control was the byword with HH. He was obsessed with controlling the lives of his players, controlling their diets, their social lives. Guardiola similarly, like, never sit still. In Spain they have a word, pesado, like kind of pain in the ass, kind of. He just doesn't let up. And I mentioned in the book, you know, Guardiola was similar in that regard. Like, when he first took on coaching the Barca B team, his first gig in coaching, he used to phone up the players after midnight on their landlines to check that they were in, and, you know, they'd get fines if they weren't. That kind of, in HH's day, was checking their hotel bedrooms and making sure they were in bed. He wouldn't let them sleep, or that they had to be in bed by 10 o'clock every night, except one night a week. You know, he was just remorseless in that sense.
Because he knew what footballers could get up to, because he was getting up to it himself.
Yeah, exactly. He didn't trust players. How could he when he didn't trust himself, when he was such a philanderer, you know, in the womanizing sense.
You talked about the cult of the manager in Barcelona. You made a documentary about Patrick O'Connell where you talked about his... I hadn't realised he was a bigamist as well as having taken the bribe and the Good Friday that Manchester United at the start of that story as well. Are there parallels here? Is it just that Barcelona inspires and incites madmen to do mad things?
I hadn't thought about that before. Yeah, huge similarities in that respect. I remember doing that radio documentary on Patrick O'Connell, Don Patricio, as he's known in Spain. And the lead into this, the story was how he saved Barca, bringing them on this fundraising tour during the Spanish Civil War to Mexico and the United States. But it quickly developed into a story about his personal life, his private life. He was a bigamist, married to two women. Curiously, they had the same name, Ellen. They're both Irish. And
I guess that's handy, right? If you're forgetting which one you're talking to.
Yeah. I don't know if it was intentional, but definitely handy. And there was a rumour that there was a third Scottish lady as well in the mix. But he was very sad. Dan Treston, who was actually a notable he worked in RTE in his lifetime, won several awards. He met him, he was reunited with him in the 1950s, not having seen him. He left the family home around the early 1920s, hadn't seen him in 30 odd years. And he was hoping for a big reconciliation. And all Don Patricio wanted to talk about was how Manchester United were doing. Treston was living in Manchester, or grew up in Manchester.
That was his son.
That was his son, yeah. So HH, similarly, very, very a poor father. Only four of his seven kids went to his funeral. I interviewed his stepson, who's an amazing figure. He's in his 90s now. He's a famous film director and was a pioneer of new journalism in the 60s, like a decade before John Didion and Hunter S. Thompson. He ghostwrote HH's memoirs in 1962, and he worked for 2 years as a scout for HH. And he talked at length about how poorly HH had treated his stepsister, Rokia, and it was really a really disgusting aspect of HH's personality. He was in love with his mother, but the kids, he didn't treat them well, and obviously his wives, he left a trail of destruction there. However, I interviewed his widow, who's still alive, Fiora Gandolfi. She's a famous journalist in Italy, and she is still to this day devoted to him. You know, she spent almost 30 years with him, and she spoke at length about his infidelities, but still, you know, he was the love of her life. Like, so that interview, more than any, gave me pause to think about him. Like, interviewing the ex-players on the balance, they loved him because he had brought such success to him. He obviously cracked the whip. It was tough love, but that interview with her was surprised me, you know.
Go on. Why? What?
Well, because of the way he treated her, you know, she was like found women in they lived in a... I did the interview with her in a palazzo, their palazzo in Venice, this amazing like mini palace apartment, dates to the 14th or 15th century, 1406, like dozens of rooms, huge apartment. And she found a woman in their bed one day, you know, she threw her clothes at her and said, get out. And, you know, would go to a perfumery in Milan and be welcomed by the woman at the perfumery saying, oh, I have the perfect perfume for you. You know, the one that your husband always brings you back to Venice when he visits. HH never got her perfume. On the day he died, he was in a hospital, and he said, here, read this letter for, I can't read this letter. And he took out this crumpled letter from under the mattress, and he said, I can't read it, the lighting is too poor in the room. It was a letter from a lover of his, and, you know, he passed away a few hours. That was the kind of last memory she had of him. So this kind of treatment, you'd think, would unsettle a woman, but she was bohemian. She, you know, spoke about how her own father took lovers. This was the way men were. So I guess there was an aspect of, you know, HH was operating in the second half of the 20th century in a machistic society, so there was a bit more tolerance of it, but it kind of amazed me that she would be tolerant.
Sometimes you come across stories like this and you think, this is a bit thin, there's, you know, I don't know if they're going to be able to stretch it to, and I'm like, would it be an 11-part Netflix? Would it be 5 seasons of Netflix to do justice to? I mean, you've managed to capture all this, but it is an incredible amount of material for, like,
yeah,
all those cliches about he led a big life. Well, this is outsized.
Yeah, yeah, and even like the book stops in 1969 or 70. I wanted to focus just on 10 or 12 years of his life, the climaxing in this manslaughter case, and the best years of his management career. He left Barca in 1960, and they were at him every second year to come back and coach again, and he did return in 79 to kind of caretaker or interim regimes, 79 to 81. So there are there is a lot of more material there to his life, but he's such a charlatan and such a colourful figure. There's a lot in his story.
That I hadn't realised until just recently that he'd actually gone back and was still there. It says like 36 games in the final caretaker, so he's basically a full season. In the 80s at Barca, when, you know, because there's so little footage of those amazing Real Madrid teams and Di Stefano and Puskas, that we don't know that much about them. And you see, I've only ever seen glimpses of that Inter team, and it's always been in that kind of Catenaccio style. But like, he's still working hard in colour TV era.
Yeah, yeah. And it was like anybody in Italy will know him from his TV punditry. He spent decades, you know, as the key TV pundit. He only died in 97. Through the 70s, he managed different teams. He went back to Inter, having left them in 68, went back again, managed, then went to Barca and won a Copa del Rey in as late as 81 with Barca. But he'd lost his magic at that stage. Interviewed a lot of journalists who remembered in Barcelona, who remembered him from that era, and they were, you know, they used to laugh at him because his eyesight was poor, and he was in his early 70s at this stage. But he wasn't the same force. But he's still the king in the press room. Like, he was very funny at there was an incident with Juanito before a Clásico game in about 81, and Juanito is the great spirit at Real Madrid. He died in a car crash in the early 90s. He's infamous for a few incidents. He stamped on Lothar Matthäus's head in a clash with Bayern Munich in the European Cup. And the spirit of Juanito is what drives your Real Madrid in the Champions League. They're famous for their comebacks. He was involved in several of them. And to this day, they chant his name in the 7th minute in European Cup games or Champions League games. Juanito, Juanito. And before this Clásico in 81, HH was asked, you know, what are you going to do with Juanito? He was the big danger man, their winger. And he said, there's nothing to worry about Juanito. He'll mark himself. And it was completely like dismiss Juanito, and you know, that was his style. Like, he still had it. His tongue was as lively as ever, but his powers were waning.
Your first book was, I think it was your first book, it was the Clásico, right? So you said you moved to Barcelona in 2010.
Yeah, second book actually.
Was it?
I wrote a book of profiles of famous Clare people with the wonderful title where Clare leads Ireland follows a couple of years before that.
Right.
Before moving to Spain.
I suspect the Clásico book outsold the Clare book.
It did. It did.
It was a bestseller. It was incredibly successful, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. Yeah. I even in Poland, it sold about 7,000 copies there. I don't think they sold any of where Clare leads Ireland follows in Warsaw.
Did you go to Barcelona in 2010 with the intention of writing that book? Is that what happened?
No, gosh, no, no. Yeah, usual story. I went to Barcelona to follow a woman who's now my wife, and we have two kids and that. So I had been living in Dublin here, working as a journalist, and moved out. And then it was just the timing. It was, I moved around January or February, and Spain, as you know, won the World Cup that summer in 2010. And it was the team of Guardiola's great, or the time of Barcelona, Guardiola's great Barca team. So I got the idea to write the book. Then I discovered there hadn't been an English language book on the rivalry, and the previous one in Spain had been 96. And it was just hugely fortunate then with the timing, because I framed the book around the season, that season 2010-2011. Mourinho had just arrived to manage Real Madrid, and it concluded that season with the famous four Clásicos in 18 days. So it was real, it was the best moment to do it, you know, Ronaldo and Messi as well at their peak.
You still see it in bookshops?
Just everybody is interested in the rivalry. Especially, God, if you're living in Spain, in Catalonia, it just dominates the talk, you know.
Was it always your intention to write about sport in sport books terms? Like, in the meantime, were you struggling to find something specific to follow it up with, and that's why this was such an obvious thing for you to do? Or were you waiting for the right thing, and this was, how did that all?
Yeah, no, I kind of fell into sports. When I moved to Spain, I just immediately started writing about football. I still play five-a-side, or try to. But I'd always been, you know, a huge Liverpool fan and stuff, always interested in sport. But my background is in features. I've written on rugby and golf and things like that, other interests. But with the passing of every year, I'm more and more into soccer. I love it because the stories are so good. You don't get those kind of stories in other sports, or they're very hard to find. I write mainly on kind of feature aspects of football, so stuff on corruption and that. I wasn't rushing to do another book after the classical one, because it's such an undertaking. I was making radio documentaries, and but I had the idea for when I got this idea for the book on HH, because of the doping aspect, the investigation. Said, yeah, there's such a good story here, but it was still a slog. Like 6 years it took to write research and write the manuscript. I'd love to do another book, but it's just such a huge undertaking, because, you know, the day job is as a journalist, and you're trying to fit it in around your family commitments as well and stuff. So it's not easy. And like radio documentaries, or working on a podcast at the moment, a podcast story, they're easier, or they're not as a big an undertaking, and they're also more social. You're working with producers and stuff like that. Books are so solitary, bar the interviews, which are great crack, great fun. Like, but it's mainly you and this mad obsession.
That comes across, like the 6 years. The list of characters is listed out at the front, and it's exhaustive. And then there's notes. And then after that, there's all the bibliography, which is actually not common, really. A lot of people will tell the story, do the thing, the acknowledgements at the front, this book is written for, and then away we go. But like, I wonder, is that partly to do with the world we live in at the moment is so disposable, that everything is short term, that everything is, I don't know why you did that. Like, is there some impetus behind, actually, I have put so much work into this, and I want to share with you the resources that I have. And I don't know, it's a welcome trend, I would suggest. But
Pain in the backside doing those end notes, because I was taking notes all the way through, like, you know, you can imagine folders of notes. But I was annotating some of them and not others. So when I did go to do the end notes, it took weeks and weeks just to do that thing. And I don't, bar scholars or other football journalists or historians or whatever, they won't like look. I never read the end notes in a book, like, but yeah, it is just to show the trail and to anybody who comes afterwards, you know, that they'll have a leg up in doing further research, and yeah, just to be a bit more professional about it.
I think it's also important in a world of AI and TikTok that actually it's written down that there's work gone into this. It wasn't my opinion. I didn't make this up. Mm. I didn't, you know, it's like I have consumed all these things, and at the end, this is the product of the consumption that I've done, as opposed to, I don't know, maybe I'm just going through a moment in life at the moment where you're like, oh my God, everything is overwhelmingly shit. Yeah. And then something like this comes along, you're like, oh, here's the product of work and research. So we've been talking a bit on the show recently about the Scorsese documentary, and it's like, I don't know if you've seen that, the Apple series.
Five parts. Yeah. No, not yet. I'm dying to see it.
It's really worth it. I'd put it off for ages and then watch it, and I was like, this couldn't be as good as I think it's going to be, and then it's actually even better. But like, there's all these people who are speaking about things that have happened, and he would draw out every frame in his head and then write it down on paper, and you're like, that's the value of work. And I see parallels here.
Yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't, but what comes to mind, just because HH is in my head, I think about him and his standards of excellence and all the things he did, you know, the 4 inches or whatever they talk about. You'd wonder how much difference any of that makes, but it's more just to give a sense of calm or confidence to people. And similarly, a book, like you'd look at a book, like I say, we'd never, as a reader, read the end notes, but it gives you a sense of confidence. Oh, okay, there's a bit of work gone into this, or, you know, he's done his the groundwork, you know.
I hope it's destined to be as big a classic as El Clasico was. It's called HH, Helenio Herrera, Football's Original Master of the Dark Arts. You've got Eamon Dunphy launching it in Hodges Figgis.
Yeah, that's a great coup. Eamon is, you know, he's a giant to broadcasting. He's an inspiration as a journalist and football writer, two of the seminal books, Only a Game and A Strange Kind of Glory. He authored them, so he's great to do it. I was on his podcast for 7 or 8 years, reporting on Spanish football and Spanish culture. So he's a good one.
Richard Fitzpatrick, congratulations.
Thanks.